It is remarkable, if you think about it, that of all the parables of Jesus, the one Hannah Fay read for us just a few moments ago is the only one in which a character is given a name. There are the parables of the Good Samaritan and the Prodigal Son, of course, but those are titles, not names. Here, one of the characters is given a name, and even more remarkably, the one with the name in this story is of a rich man and a poor man, is the poor man. His name is Lazarus, which means God helps. Jesus does not name the rich man. Now, some of you of a certain age may remember that for a long time, the Latin Vulgate misunderstood the adjective dives, which means rich, as a proper name. And thus, this parable became known as the parable of Lazarus and Dives. But the Greek does not allow the mistake. The only one with a name here is Lazarus. Says John Rolofson, from Jesus' perspective, Lazarus, although poor and hungry, is dignified with a name, even though he is paid more attention by the dogs that lick his sores than by the generic and anonymous rich man. Lazarus, in his evident need, lay in plain sight as the rich man, dressed in purple and fine linen, feasted sumptuously every day. We're meant to think of this as a repeated, even habitual action and encounter between the rich man and the poor man. Lazarus was simply part of the social landscape for this rich man, and below the notice of one who had the wherewithal to inhabit a home where the poor could be gated outside and kept at a distance. Such an understanding of the interplay between rich and poor echoes all through Luke's gospel, as does the theme of the great reversal of fortunes that Jesus promises. His clear concern for the outsider and for the poor of the land reverberates like a basso continuo through the whole of Luke's gospel. Indeed, anyone who reads Luke half awake is not shocked by the way this story ends. Jesus is unnervingly repetitive about the mortal risks that the wealthy run. These repetitions are often invoked in the developing world among Christian communities of the poor as words of hope and encouragement. At the same time, they are words that make people of wealth and abundance squirm. At least they make me squirm. Some years ago, the National Lampoon carried a cartoon that was a spoof of an old Medici rose window from the Duomo in Florence, depicting a laughing camel leaping with ease through the eye of a needle. The caption beneath the cartoon read, "A recurring motif in the works commissioned by the wealthier patrons of Renaissance religious art." And the Latin inscription on the window itself read, "Dives vincet." Wealth wins. It would certainly seem to be true if one looks around at the world today, just as it would have appeared to be true in the time of Jesus. But in his parable, Jesus offers another perspective, a chilling reminder that in the vastness of God's eternity, all our striving and all our acquiring ultimately may not be of very much help to us. In the second part of the parable, both the rich man and Lazarus die. But Jesus says they end up in different places. Lazarus ends up being transported by the angels to the bosom of Abraham, while the rich man ends up in torment in Hades. Such a reversal, as I said before, is typical of the way Luke, and indeed all of the Gospels, understand Jesus' teaching. But as John Rolofson says, the rich man doesn't get it. He sees Lazarus at a distance out there, and not recognizing the reversal that has happened, he still tries to use him to his own advantage. He says, "Send that boy to dip the tip of his finger in the water and cool my tongue, for I am in agony." It's not an idle request. It betrays habits of control. His wherewithal is gone, but his stubborn residue remains. "Send that boy," he says. But Abraham gently refuses for Lazarus, noting there is a great chasm, a great gulf between us, and reminding the rich man that he had already received his reward. That line, "a great gulf, a great chasm between us," pretty much says it all. That's where Jesus points us, it seems to me. He describes a real world that is perhaps only a slight exaggeration of the world we know, a world of great chasms and gulfs, gulfs created by economic systems, by personal and political choices. And then by the end of the story, Jesus is beckoning us toward the world which God intends. In the early 1830s, Alexis de Tocqueville visited America and was struck by what he called the general equality of condition among American people. Few were very rich, he said, and few were terribly poor. And Tocqueville felt that that condition provided fertile soil for the development of a healthy democracy. After having read the 1619 report in the New York Times in recent days, I have to say that Tocqueville missed one particular part of the American character. But today, one of the most notable aspects of American economics, and arguably the most volatile aspect of our common life as we go forward, is the steadily growing gap between rich and poor, a great gulf indeed. Now, let me be clear here. This is not a pulpit broadside against some of us gathered here today. It is a problem in which we all participate. And it will take all of us and many, many more to approach a solution. When I speak words that judge us from the pulpit, I preach first to myself. These words of Jesus call each of us and all of us here to account for the way we live vis-a-vis the poor of the world. For virtually all of us here today are counted among the rich. Now, I know not everyone would agree with that assessment. Some would argue that there are those who are far more privileged, with far more wherewithal than others, and that's true by degrees. But the fact remains, each of us here has a roof over our heads at night, and we can eat pretty much whenever we're hungry. Our friends Wally and Edwin and Coffee can attest to that's not true everywhere in the world. Those two facts alone separate us from the vast multitudes of the poor of the world, and thus separate us from the world that God intends. More importantly, the parable itself does not cut us much slack. Deeds are done, it says, and lives are led, and there are consequences. People live their little passage of time in the world, they become what they become, and then they die, and then can only be changed by forgiveness and mercy. I pray for such mercy, though I don't find it readily accessible in this parable, which seems to speak only of the consequences. This parable is not just a morality play, though, in which things work out in a tidy way with justice for the poor and punishment for the rich. Mark Harris suggests that Jesus is up to something more important here. In this story, we have the makings of a tragedy. And a tragedy is closer to the truth of the gospel than any morality play. What is deeply troubling about tragedy is that it involves more than our individual will to action or our intellects. It involves character flaws so grave that they permeate the actions of complete families and whole communities and societies. The rich man doesn't get it. It's not that he messed up by not helping Lazarus while they were both alive. Rather, it is that he could not hear or did not listen to Moses and the prophets, who had a lot to say about justice and the poor and those in need. The rich man had what Jesus in other contexts calls hardness of heart. But nothing changes for him, even after death. Indeed, Jesus makes it clear that the rich man does not understand, even now in his new estate. There he asked for mercy, but not for forgiveness. He asked for water, but not for life. Now, as with any good tragedy, the effects transfer finally to the audience. We see the tragic flaw in the rich man and recognize our own inability or unwillingness to hear and to listen to God's word as it finds its way to us. In it, in that story, we see our own hardness of heart. This text comes around in the lectionary every 3 years, at a time when most churches are beginning their stewardship campaigns. Early in my ministry, I thought that convergence was somewhat providential. The truth, however, is that this parable is a lousy stewardship text. Texts that make us feel guilty don't provide a very good foundation for stewardship, whose roots lie not in guilt, but in gratitude. Now, what this text speaks to is our attitude toward the poor, and not only the poor, who can stand on their own 2 feet and will not become a public charge, as somebody said not too long ago. This is a text that calls us to compassion and graciousness, to hospitality to the stranger, to the alien, to the refugee, and a readiness to share what we have. And we know Jesus spoke within a community that commanded both individual and collective responsibility for those in need all around us. This parable is a clarion call to listen to what Moses and the prophets and Jesus have to say about community with one another. The people who put together the lectionary link this text to the one James read earlier in this service. Paul's counsel to Timothy about the love of money being the root of all kinds of evil, and indeed it is. But the earlier interpreters of the parable of the rich man and Lazarus linked it with another text, with the part of the epistle of James that said, "For judgment will be without mercy to anyone who has shown no mercy. Mercy triumphs over judgment." Perhaps the greatest evil that the love of money inflicts on us is the way it desensitizes us to the needs of others around us and robs us of compassion and mercy and concern in the larger communities in which we live. A wise old friend once said, "We often think of wealth and poverty as opposites, but the truth is, they're synonyms, the antonym of which is community." In the end, the story of the rich man and Lazarus, as discomforting as it is, has the power to redefine community for us. What is more, it has the power to redeem our lives. It has such power because it can enable us to see ourselves and our limited perspectives and choices more clearly, to recognize our complicity in the great inequities of our time, and to consider what it would mean truly to live in community with one another. It can also help us to see something else that's very important, that whenever our wealth and wherewithal shape the moral terrain and lead us to choose the terms of our compassion toward those we deem less fortunate, we might at least have the good sense to be a little uneasy, a bit embarrassed perhaps, maybe even a bit ashamed. Doesn't mean we shouldn't act, shouldn't help. In all probability, we'll continue to extend our compassion and set the terms and limits by which we help others, and to do what we think is best based on our limited perspectives. But it may be that this parable can help us to see that the best posture to begin to shape those perspectives is on our knees.